Good morning.
I'm going to talk to you a little bit about guest worker programs and what they look like in practice. We've been at the Southern Poverty Law Center, I would say, somewhat discouraged by the range of debate about immigration reform in the United States. And what we keep hearing about is, well, we can have the status quo or we can have a big guest worker program. And I think we issued a report based on our experiences because we felt that it was important to say that maybe that's not the full range of options that are available. We issued our report a couple weeks ago, and we entitled it Close to Slavery. And frankly, we've gotten a lot of criticism for that title because, you know, obviously slavery was an abominable system and one doesn't want to devalue that in any way. And of course, we will acknowledge that the guest worker system in the United States is not a system of slavery. People aren't captured and forced to come here, and it's not a permanent system. But in practice, I think what we see as we work with guest workers every day, day in and day out, is that the system is a lot closer to slavery than any of us would be comfortable with. And the title of this report is not mere hyperbole. In practice, what we see is that these systems are perilously close to a system where people have no choice but to continue to work for a particular employer. And as a nation would suggest, before we significantly expand this system, we should look closely at how our current systems operate in practice, not on a piece of paper, but how they operate in the real world. And what we see there should give us pause. Our report is based upon years of experience in working with guest workers, representing them. I'm not an economist. I'm not generally a policy person. I am a lawyer who represents immigrants in cases. I have represented guest workers in lawsuits since 1990. And our report is based on talking to literally thousands of these workers. And I just want to say that this is not about pointing a finger and saying, look, there are a few bad apple employers using this system and we really need to figure out who they are. I have no doubt that there are nice people who use the guest worker system. The real question is, what is the structure of this system? And is the structure of this system, what it is in practice is, what we suggest is that the structure of the system itself is calculated to create, and it does create, systemic exploitation of workers. The power disparity between a worker and an employer in a guest worker program is skewed so dramatically in favor of the employer that the worker is in a kind of indentured servitude from which he cannot easily escape. Fundamentally, these workers lack the ability to walk away if they are abused or underpaid. Our report talks about H-2 workers, not because we don't think there are problems in other guest worker programs, but because that's what we know about intimately, and it seems to us that the discussion about creation of large-scale guest worker programs seem most modeled or most closely like the H-2 program, and particularly the H-2B program, which is a program that we know a lot about and have represented a lot of workers who come in under that system. H-2 workers can work only for the employer who filed the petition for them. If the employer thus decides if the worker can come to the United States, the employer decides how long he can stay, and the employer holds all of the power over the most important aspects of the worker's life. The H-2A system for agricultural workers and the H-2B system for non-agricultural workers permit U.S. employers to import people on a temporary basis from other nations when the employer certifies that qualified persons in the United States are not available and that the terms and conditions of employment will not adversely affect the wages and working conditions of similarly situated U.S. workers. But in practice, both of these programs are rife with abuses. These abuses typically start long before the worker ever gets to the United States and continue through and even after his employment in the United States. And I use his deliberately, and that is the vast majority of the workers that we see are men, and that too is part of the system I'll talk about a little bit, though certainly we've represented many women as well. Some of the abuses that I'll talk about could be avoided with a better guest worker program, but frankly, many are the foreseeable result of a system that makes people guests rather than full members of the political and economic community. One issue that I want to highlight, just following up on Mr. Marshall's comments, that is not in the report, is that I think that transparency is an issue that we should think about a lot in this process. One of the kind of ongoing themes of our work is that we're unable to even get kind of basic information about who guest workers are, where they are, what kind of work they're doing, and that's because the sort of Open Records Act FOIA system of the United States government and many state governments has basically broken down, and we are routinely denied access to that basic information. So that's an issue that I don't talk about in our report, but I think that's something we certainly want to think about, is why is it that this information is regarded by many in government as confidential, that when the stamp of approval of the United States government is given to the importation of human beings, that somehow that should be a secret, and people shouldn't be able to go out and talk to those workers or find out about those workers. I mean, what we have said is we call upon all policymakers to go talk to workers, to just find out what their lives are like in practice. We don't have a kind of unique access to these workers in our office, and we talk to these workers every day. When workers are recruited in their home countries, they are often forced to pay enormous sums of money to obtain the right to be employed at a short-term, low-wage job in the United States. It's not unusual for our Guatemalan clients, for example, to report paying anywhere from $2,500 to $5,000 for a job at which they're promised a fairly low wage for a short period of time, somewhere between 3, 6, as long as 9 months. Oftentimes, we see that the job will, in fact, even on paper, pay less than the money that is expended. We have talked to workers who have paid as much as $15,000 or $20,000 for a short-term H-2 job, particularly workers who are recruited from Asia who pay enormous sums of money. And you ask, why would someone do that? Well, the math just doesn't work out. And what we see in practice is that there's widespread fraud. Many of the Asian clients we talk to say they were promised permanent residency. They were promised 3 years of work. They were promised something very different from what they ended up with. As a practical matter, what we see also is that only indigent people are willing to do this, to get gather this sum of money, pay it in this sort of, you know, for something that's relatively speculative, and to have this kind of job. And so what we see is that none of the workers that we talk to have that kind of money. And what they're all doing is going to loan sharks and borrowing the money at extremely high interest rates. Our Guatemalan clients tell us that they have to pay 20% interest per month on their loan, and they have to pay that the entire time they're working in the United States. Another disturbingly common report that we hear from workers is that they are required to leave collateral in their home countries. And that collateral usually consists of the deed to their home, which they are required to leave with somebody. Our Guatemalan clients say that they are required to leave it with a licenciado, a lawyer in Guatemala City, as a condition of getting the employment, basically to ensure that they will comply with the terms of the contract. We had in one of our cases a fairly amazing affidavit from a client who described having to wait in a line for 8 hours to leave the deed to his home because there were 1,000 people in the line, all lined up to get these jobs. And it wasn't a question of, you know, one bad recruiter. It was a very, you know, routinized system where people waited to leave their deed and sign that over as a process to guarantee that they will not violate the contract. The fundamental problem with the work once workers get to the United States is they're only allowed to work for the employer who petitioned for them. So when they get here and the employment situation is less than ideal, the worker's only recourse is to go back home. And as I've said, almost every worker we've ever talked to has taken out enormous loans in order to get this job. As a practical matter, they cannot go back home. They will lose their home. They fear for their lives. They cannot go back home. And so workers stay, and they put up. What we see then is that guest workers routinely receive less than the law requires. In some industries that rely upon guest workers for the bulk of their workforce, seafood processing, forestry, we see that wage and hour violations are the norm and not an exception. Guest workers' position make them unlikely to complain about these violations, and public wage and hour enforcement has, frankly, minimal effect. Even when workers are paid the minimum wage in overtime, they're subject to other kinds of violations that can leave them in an equally bad situation. One common problem we see is that workers are brought in too large numbers and too early when there's very little work. And that's because employers aren't bearing the cost of bringing in these workers. Workers themselves are bearing this cost. So frankly, what does an employer care if he brings in 100 workers and he only ends up with work for 50? It doesn't cost him any more in a significant way. So workers will sit around, we see, for weeks, sometimes months, with no work, but they're paying for their housing, and they're paying on this debt, and they're paying for food. So this often leaves them in a fairly desperate situation. Similarly, when they're simply paid less than they're promised or they're legally entitled to, then they're not paid the actual prevailing wage, their recourse is fairly limited. We see in practice that workers who are injured on the job face enormous obstacles in receiving workers' compensation benefits and even reasonable medical treatment. And this is part of the kind of ad hoc state-by-state system that is workers' compensation that really hasn't been created in a way to deal with what is a transnational workforce. And so what that means in practice is that workers are disposable in a guest worker system. Workers are injured, they're sent back, they're gotten rid of, and that's the system. And it is a rare case we see where workers really receive in practice the benefits that they need and deserve when they're injured. Although these abuses are frankly routine, the government has not committed substantial resources in recent years to addressing these problems. In general, wage and hour enforcement by DOL has decreased relative to the number of workers. There are not sufficient government resources for the relatively small programs that we have now. And what we're talking about now is somewhere in the neighborhood of 150,000 guest workers under these two programs. Imagine a system in which there are literally millions of guest workers. In addition, the Department of Labor currently contends that it has no legal authority to even enforce many of the protections that workers theoretically have. For example, it contends that it doesn't have the legal right to enforce the prevailing wage for H-2B workers. There's a requirement that H-2B workers be paid the prevailing wage, but as a practical matter, if they're not paid, they have virtually no way to make that happen. We should also ask, I would suggest, as part of this discussion, why the Department of Labor has failed to promulgate regulations to protect H-2B workers. The department contends it doesn't have the authority to enforce those rights, but as a practical matter, that's largely because they haven't promulgated regulations that would allow them to do that. And so in practice, and on paper, none of the significant protections that exist even on paper for H-2A workers apply to H-2B workers, so that they don't have a right to free housing. They don't have a right to the adverse effect wage rate. They're not eligible for federally funded legal services. They don't have a three-quarters guarantee. A lot of the sort of minimal protections that exist for H-2A workers don't exist in the context of the H-2B program, which is a larger program at this time. Our report also describes another common abuse we see, which we believe is likely to continue under any kind of guest worker program, and that is that employers or supervisors routinely seize the identity documents of workers on the job, simply take their papers so they can't leave. This is one of the most common complaints we receive in our office. Literally every week we receive calls from workers who simply want to leave, often just to go home and they can't do that because the employer has taken their identity documents. There's little recourse under the law now for workers whose documents are seized. No real mechanism exists to allow workers to recover those documents, and we've had precious little interest, frankly, from the government in assisting workers under those situations. A recurring theme, then, of our report and our experiences is that workers are exploited and there is virtually no recourse to combat that exploitation. That's true in the context of workers who reside in squalid housing conditions, which we see, for example, in the H-2B program. There aren't even minimal protections for that housing. None of the legislative proposals we see talk about housing for workers at all. And another issue, I think, is that guest worker programs permit a really systematic discrimination that we would regard as both illegal and unacceptable in other aspects, in other areas of employment. And I think this is related to the kind of commodity approach you see to ordering human beings. I mean, you look at the website, some of which we cite in the report, www.mexicanworker.com, and, you know, describing workers as happy, agreeable people that we like a lot, and, you know, touting the various attributes. We see is that workers are reduced to categories and ordered as by categories like males between the age of 25 and 40. And that kind of discrimination is entrenched in the program and has even been given the stamp of approval by at least one United States Court of Appeals that said, well, that's discrimination that's happening outside the United States. That's not illegal. We think that's a wrong legal decision, but there's nothing in any of the discussions about guest worker programs to make that clearly illegal. So I would just conclude by saying that, you know, because of these abuses, we fundamentally opposed guest worker programs as a model for immigration reform. We do recognize that there are ways to make guest worker programs less abusive. We offer some of those recommendations, but I think on balance, we would not suggest that those recommendations would make guest worker programs fundamentally good, only that they might make them somewhat better. Thank you.